This is HPC Wire Soundbite, your weekly source of commentary and insight on the HPC stories shaping the industry. With Michael Feldman, editor of HPC Wire, and Addison Snell, CEO of Intersect 360 Research. And now, here are your hosts, Michael Feldman and Addison Snell.
Hello, everyone, and good morning for HPC Wire Soundbite for July 31st, 2009, available every Friday on iTunes. I'm Michael Feldman, editor of HPC Wire, and once again, standing in for Addison Snell, we have Chris Willard, the Chief Research Officer at Intersect 360. Good morning, Chris.
Morning. How are you doing, Michael?
Very good. Sort of interesting week in news, not a lot of vendor announcements, but I ran into a number of articles in the New York Times this week about some controversies surrounding the topic of algorithmic trading, something near and dear to the hearts of HPCers. So we'll play armchair financial analyst and chip in our two cents. And we also have an update on some SGI news we covered recently in HPC Wire. So let's start with the algorithm news, the algorithmic trading news. There's lately been coverage, like I said, regarding this topic. It's called high-frequency trading, algorithmic trading. Sometimes it's called predatory algorithms. This goes by a number of names. This is the applications used by large banks, hedge funds, and other financial institutions to do these sort of rapid-fire equity trades in these sub-second time frames to do sort of these arbitrage-type deals. The profits are small, sometimes pennies per share, but there are billions of these trades over the course of a year, so it adds up. I think one estimate is that high-frequency trading generated something like $20 billion in profits last year. One of the banks, Goldman Sachs, who does a lot of this, and I think if people didn't pay attention to the news, they just would have noticed that Goldman Sachs just recorded some record profits in this latest quarter, and some of that has to be attributed to the sort of algorithmic trading they do. One of the big controversies, though, and this was written about in a couple of articles in the Times, has to do with this type of trading that goes on using something called flash orders, in which some of the traders combine into these sort of private data feeds that show bids not being displayed in the public exchanges. So if you happen to be lucky enough to have a supercomputer co-located next to the exchange data and you can get access to this information before it goes public, you have a little bit of a jump start on the pricing. As you might imagine, this can lead to some mischief, or at least the potential for it, and certainly the New York Times articles talked about that, and people are saying obviously this gives high-frequency trader an unfair advantage over institutional investors and private investors that don't have these systems and can't get into these sort of private data fields. And in fact, Congress and the SEC itself is aware of the problem. There's likely to be some regulations around that, but it's really interesting to see this sort of thing going on, and everybody's sort of aware of it, and certainly the players are taking advantage of it. You know, the communication technology and the supercomputing technology is making this all possible, but it certainly does seem to tip the scales quite a bit in favor of these high-frequency traders. And the latest data is that actually high-frequency trades are up to 70% or maybe even a little bit more of the total trades going on in the exchanges, at least in the U.S. So it's actually starting to push out, you know, sort of these human trading mechanisms, just human traders, private investors, people just with PCs coming in and trying to do trades. So it really does seem to tip the scales. I mean, you've read a little bit about this, Chris. What's your take on it?
Well, my take is my first impression was that, you know, this is a case of some technology being used to, you know, to essentially attempt to beat the market that moves away from the real function of the market, which is to evaluate the value of companies and raise capital for them. And also depends upon other people actually doing that work. So I think the real issue over the long term is whether the real work of the market will be somehow put aside while people start working on very fast computer systems to somehow try to get an edge on the market. Financial markets can be viewed as software adaptive systems, in that you have a bunch of people that are watching what everyone else is doing and eventually figure it out, and then try to figure out ways to do it better in the sense of producing better payoffs than everyone else. So that certainly these sorts of problems have existed, I suspect, ever since the telegraph, probably before that, is in ways of trying to get information that the rest of the market does not have before the rest of the market gets it. Now we've gotten down to the point where you have to get that information at the microsecond level as opposed to the days or hours or minutes level. And, you know, in terms of the self-adaptive market, the issue is whether the market adapts by finding ways to avoid this, or if everyone decides it's a really good idea and starts moving in that direction, and we end up losing focus on some of the more basic activities in the market.
Right. Yeah, I guess the question is, and I talked about a little bit about this in one of my commentaries this week, can you mix supercomputers and people into the same system and have a fair fight? Basically, the supercomputing algorithms are doing speculation. Like you said, they're not doing analysis of the underlying assets in a way that brings out what's the underlying value of those assets. They're just doing correlations. They're sort of doing reverse engineering of what's already been done, and they're speculating, so they're driving prices up and down. But it seems an odd way to mix a market. You've got sort of a lot of speculation. Like I said, there's probably the majority of the trades now are being done like this, and the minority is being done by people basing their trades on long-term analysis of value. So, I mean, one of the things that one of the New York Times pieces was about is that's just distorting the markets. That when you have sort of this sub-second speculation going on with the background of other investors who are coming in and looking for long-term value, you have sort of this extreme liquidity happening, and the price discovery is just so rapid that you get the market driven down or driven up very rapidly by sort of small amounts of news. In other words, the humans react to a little bit to some news, like, you know, some CEO is sick, or, you know, they have a new product coming out, and somebody will start putting bids, and all of a sudden the supercomputers up there and sort of amplify that. And so you get this sort of volatile up and down motion. And, you know, the investors sort of get whipped around because they're always, you know, they're behind the curve now. They're now reacting to what they started, but the game is being played now and at the level of the supercomputer. So that's the larger issue. Even taking aside what I was talking about before about, you know, these flash orders that are just not public, just a larger issue of high frequency trading and the distortion of the market that might be taking place because of this. And I guess my two cents, from somebody who really can only understand the financial issues as a layman, is it does seem like the supercomputing guys are just sort of skimming the profits from the long-term investors who are in the stock market because, you know, for the traditional reasons. Over time, the economy expands, companies grow. You know, that's the whole basis of investing in companies. So if high-frequency traders are coming in and making profits of $20 billion, they basically found a way to time the market in these micro-slices, then those profits seem like they're at the expense of long-term investors. I guess if we reach a point where the investors sort of perceive there isn't a long-term profit being made, the whole system's going to break down. Do you see a danger? I mean, do you see that danger, or do you think I've read too much into what's going on here?
Well, I think there's certainly a danger in an unexpected feedback loop producing great market volatility over very short periods of time, and we're into the thousandth of a second at this point. So it'd be, you know, before anyone could hit the switch to say stop, we could see big changes in the market. I am right now less concerned about long-term investing, but it may drive a lot of the intermediate-term people out of the market. And the question is can these essentially arbitrage methods siphon off long-term profits one cent at a time over the long term, so that anytime there is a profit beginning to show up, that someone's able to snatch it. And I'm not sure. Just intuitively that is so much the case, but you've looked into this far more closely than I have.
Well, and just from my perspective, like I, it does sort of seem like a zero-sum game in the sense that the traders aren't coming in and making value for these companies. So if they're taking money out of it, if they're making a profit, it seems like that profit is now at the expense of somebody else making a profit. And if the traders, high-frequency traders in general, are making $20 billion a year, then that's coming out of somebody else.
Well, that's true. That is. And I guess the question is $20 billion a year a large amount of profit relative to the total flow of monies and profits through the stock exchange?
Right. And that's the question I think a lot of people think about like that is are the speculators going to dominate the market? I mean, there's probably a role for speculators and long-term investors in any given market, but if one or the other takes hold, then things become out of whack. And yeah, maybe $20 billion, maybe the market can survive that. But we've seen algorithmic trading go up. I think there was one metric I read, it's 164% more than it was in 2005, just 4 years ago. If it starts eating more and more into the market, you know, we might see more and more of this kind of behavior and more volatility. So
well,
it'll be interesting to see happens.
I mean, we're still recovering from a computer-generated, in large part, financial fiasco with the, you know, with collateral debt obligations and so on and so forth, where the market really got away from some of its major tasks and major valuations and put a lot of money in what proved later on to be very bad investments, and everyone knows the story from there. So, you know, it concerns me at a philosophical level that that people become enamored with the technology and start, you know, grab the technology and run with it like a, you know, sort of like a new car and just, let's see what this baby will do, and eventually find out its limits when they hit the wall. And maybe I'm just a little shell-shocked, but hearing about this makes me wonder if we've just got out of one sports car and jumped into another one.
Right. And I think that was the point of one of the New York Times writers, the op-ed writers, that, we're heading into the next panic where it's just another type of speculation that, you know, based on some assumptions that's been codified into algorithms that everybody just trusts sort of blindly. So I think it's something we're going to have to watch and not be too shocked if we get some bad results again. Let's jump into the next news, which isn't really related, but it has to do with something I think we talked about on the last show, and we wrote about in HPC Wire a week or two ago. It has to do with the SGI roadmap. I wrote an article based mostly on a conversation I had with Greg Knorr, who's the senior director, or Jeff Knorr, senior director of product marketing at SGI. We talked about the basic roadmap of the company and the systems they're going to be sticking with and rebranding to a certain extent, but also gave me some hints about the most interesting new product line, which is based on the ultraviolet architecture. And he gave me the impression that they're basically switching to Mahalan chips, the Intel Xeon chips that are coming out. The Mahalan EX specifically were going to be in the first version of the ultraviolet machines coming out probably sometime next year. And those are going to be the shared memory machines, which would basically take over their current shared memory line, which is the current Alpix 4700 series, which are Titanium-based. And so I and just so happens the other publication that he talked to, E-Week, had the same impression that they were basically phasing out the Titanium-based machines over some period of time. Well, the next day after HPC Wire and E-Week reported that news, Mark Barrenechea, the CEO of SGI, wrote a blog saying that, no, in fact, they were 100% committed to Titanium and implied that perhaps later ultraviolet machines may indeed use Titanium processors as well as Intel Xeon processors. I thought the term of 100% committed to Titanium was a little odd because you really kind of hedged later if that was really going to occur, but certainly in the short term, he seemed quite committed to it. And I came away feeling a little bit confused. I mean, I think, you know, they were trying to get this message out about ultraviolet and sort of the good news around, yes, they're going to add these nifty new Mahalan EX chips, and they're going to build these quite interesting shared memory systems out of it. But it sounds like they haven't quite figured out the rest of the message yet. So it was a little bit strange for me, and probably for SGI too, to sort of have this go on. Chris, you read some of this. What do you make of this? What do you think SGI's real strategy is around, Itanium now?
Last week we talked about the difficulty in moving away from a product, and from the 50,000 point view, we can point to all the good business reasons why a company might want to move away from Itanium. Particularly a smaller company like SGI, they have two technology teams that might be better combined and concentrated in one area rather than building modules or nodes based on two different processors. There's the software stack and the compilers and the libraries, the user support personnel, the engineer, the site engineer personnel that all have to be kept up to date on both technologies. There's also the sales and marketing materials and training the sales force that are all expensive for one product that has not really captured the imagination of the market. And as time has gone by, is less and less differentiated, at least in terms of cycle times and a lot of the raw performance measures from other products inside the marketplace. But then you sort of go from the 50,000 feet down to ground level and run into the real issues around who are your customers, what have you committed to, and what sort of real revenue opportunities are out there. So that companies, perhaps one of the most difficult things a computer company has to do is make a transition from one major technology to another. And sometimes those transitions require very, very, very careful calculation as to where the customer base is and what sort of revenue can be expected in actual sales for each technology.
Right.
So that we just may have seen them sort of floating a rumor and see what sort of feedback they got. And it doesn't sound like it was terribly positive, at least from some of their clients.
Yeah, that's certainly a possibility. I mean, it's interesting you mentioned sales because I think in the original article that I wrote, I glanced through the top 500 list looking for the prevalence of the shared memory Altix systems on that list, assuming that if there were those systems, they would end up on that top 500 list. And I only found three systems, one of which was the older Columbia machine at NASA, which is their previous generation Itanium machine. So unless there's a whole lot of Itanium machines, Altix Itaniums out there that somehow never made it on that list, it doesn't seem like the sales opportunity is that big. So I understand what you're saying. The idea is you have to balance the current customer base you have, the people that already have it, like NASA obviously is a big customer, and they have some dependence on Itanium support. But certainly now that they've made this new company, it would have seemed like a logical time to sort of make this sort of break if they looked ahead and thought, oh, okay, this line isn't gonna bring us the revenue, isn't gonna balance the revenue with the amount of R&D that will need that support. So again, I don't have all the visibility into their structure, but it does seem like sort of a hard decision for them if they're going to continue this indefinitely or for a while until it becomes just totally untenable. I'm not sure what else they need to see, but I guess they do need to keep current customers happy, and maybe they have future customers out there that we don't even know about, or customers that, like I said, don't show up on the top 500 list and are demanding machines that are Itanium based. I don't know.
It will be very interesting to see if Itanium makes a comeback in the market, particularly at SGI. I would suspect that probably what we'll see is perhaps a more measured phase out over time, and that essentially the company has to go where the market is leading it, and unless you have some customers that are willing to really foot the bill and make a special technology or a low volume technology very profitable for you, you eventually have to move away from it. But
right.
The sort of path to move away from it and coordination with your customers, that are committed to that technology is a very delicate and difficult situation.
Yeah, one of the challenges SGI is going to have to grapple with, but they knew that when they did the merger, so we'll definitely be following it, and I'm certainly will be talking about this in the months and hopefully years ahead. Well, I think for now that's going to do it. Chris will probably have Madison back next week, but it's been great having you on the show for the past couple of weeks. I really appreciate it and really interesting insight, and hope the best for you, and hopefully we can bring you back on the show for some more guest appearances.
Oh, that'd be great. It's been a pleasure.
Okay, until next week, so long, and we'll be doing this again 7 days from now. So long, everyone.
You've been listening to HPC Wire Soundbite with Michael Feldman and Addison Snell. Got a question or comment for Michael or Addison? Email soundbite@hpcwire.com. HPC Wire Soundbite is available every Friday afternoon from iTunes or at hpcwire.com. HPC Wire, the leading source for global news and information covering the ecosystem of high productivity computing.